Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the latest edition of You Have Tread on Me. Today
is Mr. Dukeman.
Wait a minute, let's stop that. We don't have time for that. Today is May 23rd, 2010, and our guest tonight is Gary Hunt, and we'll be concluding the final chapter of the Waco and Eyewitness Account. I want to thank everybody for joining us again, and welcome to the show. If you have any questions, the call-in number is 646-716-4518. All questions are welcome. If you cannot call in, you can drop your questions into the chat room, either at the Blog Talk chat room or on our You Have Tread on Me chat room at www.youhavetreadonme.com. So with that being said, Gary, let's just jump right into it. Do you want to rehash a little bit where we were at before, or do you want to just continue on from where we were? Your show, where are you at?
Well, I'll tell you what. What do you think needs rehashing? You pointed out, and I'll talk about it.
Well, I think we've been pretty much clear on everything that's gone on so far. I mean, we've done 3 hours so far on Waco, so I'm pretty good with where we were on everything else. So you want to just jump in then from where we left off and continue on?
Well, I think we were we go over in detail what the big lie had presented a lot of false information, and I don't know if we went over all that or not.
No, let's start with that, because I know that we started touching on it, but we had run out of time. We were just beginning to touch on that area just before we ran out of time.
Okay, well, the Waco the Big Lie was a very popular video at the time, and people assumed it was representing the truth. It thought that it was saying that Waco, what the government was telling us, was the big lie, but in fact, it was the big lie. The things that were represented in, probably the most significant thing is the infamous flame-throwing tank. That video was built around a bit of footage that was captured on the uplink to the satellites, live footage that was captured on the uplink. And then it was presented with a dialogue over the top of it talking about this being a flame-throwing tank. And when I got back to Waco in May of 93 and went to the hotel the Davidians were staying in, they showed me the video. And, you know, it astounded me. I mean, we didn't see anything like that the day it happened. And I found out later that Ken Fawcett had provided Linda Thompson the footage. And perhaps even helped her doctor it, but there were some things really wrong with the flame-throwing tank. One is it was 35 minutes before the fire started. Two is there was no dripping naphtha. When you shut down a flamethrower, usually there's a few drops of burning fuel that just fall to the ground. They're not under pressure. There's usually a high carbonic smoke on it. When they're mounted on a tank or on a vehicle, they're always mounted in the front of the tank or the vehicle. This one was on the side near the turret, which, if you used it enough, would cook the guys inside. And so I came to the conclusion after watching it a couple times that there was no flame-throwing tank there and we were being deceived. Now, it was a bad position to take because everybody wanted to believe that there was a flame-throwing tank in Waco. And eventually, Mike McNulty came out with the full footage, and I got a copy before he released his video, and so I released that portion for him. But the original video showed the tank breaking into near the front of the building, breaking into the bedroom area. The men slept downstairs, the women slept upstairs, and I'm not sure whose bedroom it was going into, but it goes in and out and in and out, and then it has a very triangular shape pointing towards the building, elongated a triangular shape, a very bright, looks almost like flame, but there's no flicker to it. And that's the alleged flame-throwing tank, which, if you look at it, the flamethrower was on the whole time. Went on and stayed on. It didn't shoot and burst. It just stayed on. But it goes in and then comes back out. And that ends the footage. And everybody either wanted to or was led into believing there was a flamethrowing tank. Well, when we finally got the footage, If they had left the next 5 or 6 seconds on, the tank continues to back away from the building, and then the flame falls to the ground and bounces. And that's characteristic of a flame. There was a claim that there was a fire in the underground bunker. The government called it a bunker. What it was a storm shelter. It was from in the Mount Carmel. You would go down into a tunnel area, then go through an old school bus that was buried, and then after the bus, you would go to a storm shelter. Now, they had built the roof on the storm shelter eventually, but they didn't realize the weight of water and dirt together, and so they were in the process of restoring the storm shelter, the Davidians were, when this all occurred. Part of it was open and exposed.
Okay.
Linda Thompson said there's smoke coming out there. They've put fire in the bunker. They're burning the women and children. Now, Bob Rick said that the women and children could have come out through the tornado shelter. But in fact, that the smoke you saw was tear gas being injected into the underground bus, that whole area, so that nobody could come out that way. And we'll get into coming out later on.
Okay.
Nobody could come out that way. So the women and children could not come out like Rick told us they could, but there was no fire in there. And if you go to the outpostoffreedom.com webpage and go to the Waco pictures, you'll see a picture. There's a rubber glove hanging from the rafter in there, you know, the kitchen-type glove.
Right.
It's not melted. There was no fire. There's a light bulb, not blackened, not exploded from a fire. It was just, it had to be smoke that was coming out of there, tear gas smoke, because there was no indication, the wood's not charred, nothing. So, line number two. Next was, what?
I've got a question there. So the flame-throwing tank, was that valid or was that invalid?
It was invalid.
Okay, so there wasn't a flame-throwing tank. There wasn't a napalm-spewing tank or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
And the reasons, without the footage, the reasons, as I said, there was no dripping naphtha, there was no carbonic, the black smoke that's typical. The flame stayed on. It didn't spurt when necessary. It was mounted the wrong place on the tank. They would never mount it on the side of the tank. And the time stamp on that was 35 minutes before the fire began.
Okay, okay. All right, so the whole footage then was doctored.
No, it wasn't doctored. It was just chopped off, edited.
Okay, okay.
It wasn't modified in any way. She just cut the last few seconds off so you didn't see the flame bounce on the ground.
Okay.
I mean, it just hit the ground and bounced and then flopped over. Not typical of a flame.
Okay, yeah, you're very right there.
But it took years for people to recognize, the analogy I used is when people get on a bandwagon, it's very hard to get off the bandwagon. So they wanted so desperately, after believing there was a flame-throwing tank, to believe there was one. It was many years before people finally gave up on the notion of the flame-throwing tank. They would have to watch the McNulty footage over and over and over again, and get out of their head what they first perceived there. And it was, unfortunately, a difficult task that so many people were deceived so much and held on to that belief for so long. It kind of demonstrates lack of objectivity on the part of some people when they want desperately to believe something. And I'm not trying to be critical, but I am trying to be present an observation from experience on our tendency to pick up rumors that are really damaging to the patriot community. If there's not absolute proof of something, all we can do is look foolish by trying to live by it.
I agree and concur with you 100%.
So let's see, Peter Jem's body, and I don't recall now what she said about Peter Jem's body, but Peter Jem's body, Peter Gent on the February 28th, he had climbed up the water tower. Whether he had a rifle or not, I do not know. But we were able to see his body on the top of the water tower, a black blot up there for days. The Davidians let the BATF come in and get their dead and wounded and remove them from the scene. However, the BTF, being the good guys, would not let the Davidians recover Peter Gent's body until I think it was March 6th. And then they were allowed to go up and recover his body off the top of the water tower. Now, the water tower was not a water tower. It's been referred to as that. It was being set up to be a storage facility. They had stairwells and landings all the way to the top, and it had a hatch on the top. That's where Peter Gent was. He probably had a rifle and was going to defend the Davidians. He may have been out in the tower when this occurred, and there was a rifle out there. I'm not sure what all was behind that, but the fact is the government let his body lay there in the hot Waco sun for 6 days before they finally gave the Davidians permission to bury him. Now, the Davidians were going to bury him in the underground area, but the body stank so much from sitting out in the sun and decomposing that they decided to bury him out by a tree that had been planted in the front of the property. The other people that died that day were buried in the underground area. And, you know, the FBI kindly showed the funeral, showing what nice guys they were, and allowed the Davidians to come out and bury the body under cover of rifle, obviously, but allowed them to come out. But there's another thing in the video that a lot of people remember, and they'll remember three agents going up on the roof. Two of them climb in a window. The third one waits outside. And Linda Thompson, then, the guy that's outside, you see some smoke coming from inside. The guy outside looks inside, and when he swings around, his rifle is pointing towards the window, but then he backs away from it, and you start seeing holes coming out of the wall. She claimed that he was assassinating the other two agents because they were one was a Clinton bodyguard, and I forgot what the other story was, and so this was a setup to kill these two agents. Well, that's good hype, I guess, and the story about the agents came out later because everybody's wondering, well, why would they shoot him? And, well, he was a Clinton bodyguard. At any rate, the way those two agents died and what caused the bullets to come out through the wall was Scott Sinobi, who died in the fire on the 19th of April, had been coming down the stairs. He had just got his Glock and was coming down the stairs. And he heard a noise in what used to be David's bedroom, which is possibly why the agents went in there. They thought they might be able to grab David. He heard the agents in there, and he looked in and saw the agents, and he popped off 16 rounds at the agents that were in that room, and that some of the bullets went out through the wall. So it wasn't an agent assassinating two other agents.
Okay.
There was one other one about an agent on a ladder, and, you know, it's been a long time, and I don't recall exactly what Thompson said about that, but her line on that was misleading, too. If anybody has looked at that recently and remembers an agent on the ladder, well, I think it had to do with throwing tear gas into the chapel part of the building or the gym. But, again, it was as bogus as most of the footage. So anyway, on April 19th, I don't recall what time in the morning it was, but all of a sudden, not tanks, but tank retrievers, they have an A-frame boom on them, begin busting walls, breaking into the building at different points with that A-frame boom. Now, the A-frame boom, the reason they used that is they had a nozzle on the end of that, and they had a pressurized gas system to inject CS gas into Mount Carmel Center. It would be the same gas that they put in the bunker that I mentioned earlier, or the tornado shelter. They claim that the CS gas wasn't harmful. They did acknowledge that it was not tear gas, it was CS gas. In the Army, we called it chicken shit gas, but the way it was described to us then is it's not tear gas, which is a pepper base, but it's a chemical, and it is a mild nerve agent. It's very much an irritant, and when we took the gas mask course, we had to go through the gas chamber with CS gas in it. And it wastes you, man. You get to where you can't do anything. I mean, I could walk through tear gas compared to this stuff. And they started injecting it into the building and poking holes in the building. In the process of poking holes in the building, they managed to destroy exiting the building through the front door. They caused damage around it that caused the framework to lock the doors down. So they destroyed the egress from the building, at least at a couple of points. The people that did escape from Mount Carmel on the April 19th during the fire came out of the second floor front. Well, two places. One, you might recall seeing somebody climb out and dropped onto the roof where the agents had gone in. And drop down from there and then walk out and get arrested. Clive Doyle went out through a hole in the wall where the tear gas was injected into the chapel. Most of the ladies were on the second floor that got out, were on the second floor and jumped through the flames. It's very hard to pick them out in any of the footage, but they jumped out through the flames to the ground. But everybody that came out that day came out the front of the building or the right side of the building, which just happened to be the only two sides of the building facing the satellite city, the cameras, the high-powered cameras they had back about a mile and a half away. There were other ways of getting out. One would have been through the bus and into the underground bunker, or the storm shelter, out through the gym, out through the door behind the kitchen, which was just behind what they call the inside bunker, which was originally a safe from the original church, but they didn't need a safe, so they took the doors off, and they used it as a cooler. They used it to keep vegetables cool. Rather than refrigerate them, they kept them in the concrete room, and I would imagine they sprinkled water in there from time to time, and that evaporative cooling will keep vegetables at a cooler temperature than the surrounding air. But the women and children that might have tried to get out through the kitchen could not get out. Now, we don't have any evidence that that was blocked, but if you remember the subsequent footage that Mike McNulty came out with later that he got under the Freedom of Information Act, you might recall that there appears to be rifle fire coming from back away from the building, back where the gymnasium was, and it seems to be directed in the vicinity of the back door by the kitchen. Now, if the women and children did want to go out that back door out of camera view, we don't have any substantial proof, but everything seems to point to the fact that they were being shot if they tried to get out. That would give now. Then, in an effort to save their children's lives, they went into that storage, the cooler, the storage area.
Right.
They could not go to the bus. They could not go out the back door, so they went in that concrete, what used to be a safe, inside of Mount Carmel Center, where they were either cooked to death or killed by their own hand.
So they were committing suicide in there?
I wouldn't call it committing suicide. If you have a child and the flames are getting intense and the temperature's up 300 or 400 degrees and that pain is there, would you kill your child quickly to avoid him having to go through the pain and scream? And you have to tolerate the screaming? Death is inevitable and immediate, or nearly immediate. I wouldn't call it suicide.
No, you're right. It's just a choice of how you're going to go at that point.
Right, and not suffering the painful method that was being imposed on them by the government. So those that died in there very well could have wanted to get out, which would explain why they were all clustered in that one area very near the kitchen door, knowing they could not go out the front door. And when they found out they couldn't get out the kitchen door, it became a course of last resort to hide in that concrete building and then die there by their own hand or by the fire. Derek Lovelock, when he got back to England, was willing to talk to me a little bit about what happened. Now, the problem was by the destruction that was caused, a lot of people didn't have access to other areas. Clive Doyle, for example, was in the chapel, and he couldn't go back towards the gym because of the fire. He could not go back towards the main part of the house because of the fire. A number of people were in the chapel. When it started burning intensely in there, the fire had come up both hallways into the chapel. He noticed that there was a break in the wall, and there were flames covering the break, but he could see through the flicker that it went to outside, and he just ran and jumped through that and survived. Ruth Riddle talked about being up on the second floor, and the floors were buckled, and everybody was afraid to walk down the hallway. Now, she jumped out on the left front side. People were getting out that could get out were getting out any way they could. Derek Lovelock was reluctant to say a lot. Now, he had been gone back to England. The English government got the government to release him rather than put him in jail. Otherwise, he would have been charged like everybody else, but he was a British citizen. And I don't think the people in England looked at what happened in Waco the same way most Americans do. They saw it as an atrocity, not by the Davidians either. But he suggested that he believes that there was gunfire and there was an effort to try and keep everybody in that building so that they would be cooked. It's just his opinion. He doesn't have anything to substantiate it, but by being there and just what he was aware of, that nobody, he doesn't understand why people didn't come out. He knows they would have tried to come out. It's just his opinion. The government, as soon as the fire was out, began a cleanup. Now, before then, they had assigned the Texas Rangers as the official crime scene investigators for the Mount Carmel Center. But on the day of the fire and the next day, the BATF and the FBI had a little bobcat bulldozer, and their agents were going all over the scene. They were pushing debris around, doing all kinds of things, and finally they let the Texas Rangers on to the scene. Now, were they trying to destroy evidence? The Texas Rangers did find incendiary projectiles, not tear gas, as Rick's told us, but they were, 20 millimeter, those little grenade rounds, I think it's 20 millimeter, 30 millimeter, something
yeah,
like
I think
that.
They are.
Pardon?
Aren't they 40 millimeter incendiary?
40 millimeter. Yeah, I guess it would be about 40 millimeter.
Yeah, 40 millimeter.
A little over an inch and a half. 40 millimeter rounds, and the casing on it, it was an incendiary grenade. In fact, the 8-inch high stack of evidence lists three identified incendiary devices. Not tear gas, but incendiary. I-N-C-E-N-D-I-A-R-Y, whatever it is. They said incendiary on them. The government denies that there were any incendiary devices used. And I don't know, in talking with the Davidians, they weren't aware of them having any incendiary devices at all. So it's kind of hard to explain away that the fire was caused by the Davidians, which is the government's claim, when the government did so much. Now, if you're a fire starter, I hate to say a fire starter, but if you go camping and you want to start a fire, you can stack your sticks real tight where air doesn't get in and it won't light. You have to have air flowing through it. There was a pretty brisk wind in Waco that day. And what they did is they knew the building was old. They knew that the lead-based paint, oil-based paint, had been used on the building that the church had been made out of, the old buildings that sat on the property. They knew the wood was dry from baking for 20 or 30 years in the Texas sun. David, in the interviews with them, even admitted that that place was a tinderbox. It was very volatile. They had, the Davidians have told me, the rigid rules they had about fire inside the building, because they knew that the house could go up in no time. They did not have a sprinkler system on it or anything. But had the building not been aerated by all these holes pushed in it, it wouldn't have burned nearly as quickly, because it would have consumed the oxygen inside the building. But when you put large holes on the windward side of the building, which would be the right side, the gym and the chapel on the right side, when you put large holes in the building and air can come through and feed that fire, then you have a building that large that goes to the ground in about 15 minutes. Everything together, it just seems that the government was doing everything they could to destroy as much evidence as possible, and then took a day and a half afterwards to go through and remove any evidence of their misdeeds before the Texas Rangers were allowed in there. But it was such a phenomenal task that they overlooked a few things. You're all aware of the trial. Nine Davidians stood trial on rather serious charges. The numerous charges, what I refer to as the government shotgun of charges. What they do is they throw so many charges at somebody that something's got to stick. And when I talked to Sarah Bain after the jury came back with their verdict, she pretty much confirmed what I thought was going to happen. What she explained to me was that the jury didn't feel that the Davidians had done anything wrong, but they just felt that since the government had so many charges, that they must be guilty of something. So the jury looked at the charges and looked at the lowest punishment on the list of charges. The lowest punishment, and I don't remember if it was 3 or 5 years now, something relatively low, and decided that would be the charge that they would find them guilty of. That charge was the use of a firearm in the commission of a crime. Now, presumably, if I understand English, if I use something A in doing something B, then I had to be doing something B to be charged with doing something with A while doing B.
Correct.
So I would have to be guilty of a crime to be guilty of use of a firearm during the commission of a crime. Well, not in this country. Everybody was convicted of use of firearm during the commission of a crime. However, they were not convicted of a crime. To compound that, the judge determined that since they used automatic weapons, which was never really proven in trial, they brought in charred remains and said, these are automatic weapons. We're experts. We're the BATF. But the jury didn't buy that, but the judge did, and so he added on to the sentences, because they were automatic weapons used in the commission of a crime that did not occur. And so the lowest sentence was 9 years. Some got higher sentences, and I don't recall what the specific charges are. So that's justice in America.
Well, we can see the same thing happening today with the Hutter Reef, for instance. They were convicted. They're being charged for a non-crime. No crime was ever committed. Thought crime. Thought crime is now, I guess it's pre-crime, just like in, what was that movie with Tom Cruise, where the whole pre-crime police group, they go back in time, arrest people before they commit crimes, even though they could have.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You know? So So now we have thoughts
have
on it.
You know,
if you think about doing
now.
Something that the government doesn't like, they can charge you for that crime even before you do it.
Well, that makes sense. I wrote an article after the Hutterite militia, because that really ticks me off, the thought crimes. I'll post the link on one of the chats as soon as
I post it on one of them. I'll get it to the other one.
And we don't want to have dead air time, so I'll keep talking, even though I won't be saying anything.
I have a question for you.
What?
I have a question for you. Their attorneys, for the people that were charged with using a gun during the commission of a crime, did they ever qualify what the crime was that they used a firearm?
No, they didn't. They were not convicted of any crime. Except use of a firearm in the commission of a crime. I know it just destroys the English language if you think about what I just told you. How can it possibly be that the crime that they must have been committing was having the firearm during the commission of a crime? It just, you know, language cannot put it together.
So I guess the main question, the reason I was asking is because you would think that their attorneys, would be able to just destroy that whole thing. How do you get charged with a crime if you're not being charged with a crime? How can you be sentenced for a crime if there was no crime committed and you weren't convicted of that crime?
Well, they weren't convicted of a crime. They were convicted of use of the firearm in the commission of a crime.
This
remind me of Abbott and Costello on Who's on First?
Right. That's what I'm saying. I mean, if I was of using a gun in a bank robbery, but I was never convicted of a bank robbery, then how am I guilty of using a gun during a bank robbery?
Right. Now, what was the, you know, if it was bank robbery and you weren't near the bank and were convicted of use of a firearm and the commission of a robbery of a bank that you weren't even near, now you're coming close to what happened to the Davidians. And they got 9 years in prison for it. Now, the government looks out for its own. Two of the BATF agents were fired sometime after Waco or released or let go or something. And I don't recall their names now, but they threatened to go, and this hit the news at the time. They threatened to go public with the story of what happened at Waco, and they got their jobs back and their pensions back. So the judges look out for the cops,
the government
cops look out for the judges. And that's our opposition.
You know, as we've always known, government is a monopoly. Government has a monopoly on everything, including the use of force. Any government that begins to become totalitarian or exceeds the boundaries of a free republic, the first thing they do is they start to monopolize the use of force. Nobody can defend themselves unless you happen to be government, and those who are government, well, then they can do most anything they need to because they come under protection of said government. And when you try to take them to court, whose courts do you go to? You go to their courts with the gold fringes, with the gold fringe flag in it.
Where everything's enforced by their police officers, who they protect. Now, George Sibley and Linda Lyon were executed in Alabama for shooting a cop. If the cop had shot them, he would have gotten time off with pay pending investigation, and then they would have determined it was justifiable homicide, and nothing would have happened. That's how it works in this country today.
Because they have the monopoly on the use of force.
I didn't hear that. What was it?
Well, I said it's because they have the monopoly on the use of force.
Right. They own it. And they justify it in their case and make anything we do unjustified. I want to read you. There's a jurisdictional question that arose there, and that is, does the BATF have any authority on non-sovereign land, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, land in this country? Well, here's from Texas Penal Code, Section 9.31C. The use of force to resist an arrest or search is justified, 1, if before the actors offer any resistance, the peace officer or person acting at his direction uses or attempts to use greater force than necessary to make the arrest or search. And two, when and to the degree the actor reasonably believes the force is immediately necessary to protect himself against the peace officers or other persons' use or attempted use of greater force than necessary. So I'm going to go back to number one. If before the actor, which would be the Davidians in this case, offers any resistance, the peace officers or persons acting at his direction uses or attempts to use greater force than necessary to make the arrest or search. Now, if you can imagine two cattle trucks loaded with body-armored, helmeted thugs with full automatic rifles jumping out of the back of them and then lining up and facing your building, is that greater force than is necessary for an arrest?
Well, you know, there was a recent case of a strapping young police officer in the States, somewhere down south, I forgot the exact state or county, but he pulled over a 70-year-old lady. He felt that this lady presented severe, you know, presented the threat of harm or severe, or, you know, severe bodily harm or death to him. So he immediately went for his taser and tasered her to death. I don't know. The cop is sitting there with a level 3A vest, trauma plates front and back. He's a state trooper, which means he had numerous guns on him because every state cop I've ever known, which was many of them, had at least 8 or 9 guns just on their body. Plus, unarmed defensive tactics, expandable batons or expandable PR-24s, chemical agent. Did he exceed the use of force there? And I think that we, you know, if you look at the police requirements for the escalation of use of force, first one is verbal de-escalation. The next phase that they're allowed to go to is unarmed defensive tactics. Third from there is chemical agent. Fourth at that point would be impact weapons to large muscle groups. At that point, they would then be allowed to go to tasers and then firearms if the threat of death was, or if the threat of severe bodily harm or death was a possibility to themselves or the general public. He just went straight to the taser and killed her. Did that exceed
you? Taser's non-lethal. How can he kill her with a non-lethal weapon?
With a taser?
Yeah. I know you can do it. I know, but it's considered a non-lethal weapon.
Well, you know, I guess they're finding out, man, that the taser is an extremely lethal weapon.
Yeah, it is, especially if they hold the trigger down.
Well, apparently he held it down and just kept going.
Yeah.
And kept going and kept going.
The old shock things, you had to make contact. You held it in your hand and you had to get both electrodes on the other person.
Right.
Which means they could pull away after they were shocked. But the tasers now that have that little pin that sticks in you, and then you've got there's a wire from that to the gun, and as long as the battery lasts, they can hold that trigger down and put a lot of volts in somebody, which can be disruptive to a bad heart and I'm sure other causes. Now, let's look at the Founding Fathers. One of the things that they understood, and in fact, English history, going back to the Magna Carta, understood that man has a right to protect his life and his property and his liberty. All three are mentioned in the founding documents. Jefferson changed the pursuit of happiness, but property was used more often than not because the acquisition of property is really what you need to have happiness.
Exactly.
You don't have a roof over your head. But the fundamental right to be able to protect your life, especially, face it, without your life, you have nothing. So the right to protect your life is inherent. The right of self-defense. The Supreme Court has upheld that right in the past over and over again.
Well, you mentioned a case earlier where a gentleman shot a police officer. What's that?
John Bad Elk, yes.
John Bad Elk, yes.
And they
came to arrest him, and he refused to go.
Over and over, he was protecting his liberty, not his life. because nobody had a gun threatened at him. But Texas
right.
law, the one that I read you, makes it very clear that you have a right to protect your life and your property, because if he's going to use force, if he uses force greater than necessary, and, you know, that might be hard to judge, and that's what jury trials are for. But the problem was there was no trial under Texas law over the BATF because the federal government has stolen jurisdiction. If the BATF and the Davidians had faced off in a trial over whether excessive force was used in their, or attempted or not, I'm sure the verdict would have been unanimous against the BATF, having all these 20-some thugs jump out with body armor, fully protected. And then there's an old theory, something I remember my grandfather told me a long time ago. Now, he was a barber. Back in the early 19th or early 20th century, a lot of people still carried guns because, you know, there were risks out there. It could be wolves, could be highwaymen or anything. But he always told me, you never draw a gun unless you intend to use it. And so I've always wondered that if when a cop, which has happened many times, when a cop pulls a gun on me, does he intend to kill me? If he says you're under arrest and I say fuck you, is he going to shoot me? Pardon my language. If he says you're under arrest and I turn around and walk away, is he going to shoot me? He's got the gun out for a reason, and it's not just to say, hey, listen to me, I'm a cop, because he's got a badge on for that. In fact, I would have more respect for the badge than I would for the gun, because the gun is him saying, I'll kill you if you don't do what I want you to do. And that's very bothersome in when you understand enough about our culture and how important our right to self-defense, to protect ourselves, really is. Because when he pulls that gun out, I can't think of any other reason for him pulling it out than he intends to shoot you. Unless you do exactly what he says.
That's the implication there, even if it's not said.
I can't.
If anybody pulls a gun on me,
their conclusion,
I would think that they're going to shoot me.
He's going to pull it out I can't think of anything to place on that line except shoot me.
Yeah.
There's nothing that fits. He's pulling it out just for show. He wants his picture taken. Nope. No photographer. He's pulling it out to open a beer bottle. Nope. He doesn't have a beer bottle. I cannot figure out why he pulls it out unless he's going to shoot me. It shouldn't be that way in this country. There is no reason, there's no justification in the world for the police to be able to pull a gun on you like that. Now, if we go back in history, there were two concerns about standing armies. One was they could be used like they were in Boston. And the other one was they become a means of perpetual war, which England was doing pretty damn good at. Except back then they got booty, because when they were at war, if they got French or Spanish ships, they'd take the cargo, they'd take the gold and the jewels, and they'd sell, get ransom on anybody of any wealth. They'd conscript the seamen to serve the crown. So they got booty out of it. We don't do that in war now, I guess. We don't get, there's no booty anymore. I'm not sure. But there was perpetual war. And now, how do you fund perpetual war? If you have booty, you can fund it with booty, unless you don't get enough booty to fund the war. But if you can tax people 20% of their income, you have the means of perpetual war. But the other concern, standing armies, was facing against the people themselves. And interestingly, if we go back to the Magna Carta, from the Magna Carta forward, the military force will always be subordinate to the civil force. So something called the Boston Massacre, where the soldiers defending their lives, wait, they were defending their lives because they were being attacked by a crowd throwing rocks, sticks, ice, stones, everything. They had to go to trial for that because they did not have permission from the civil authority to use their guns. They were acquitted after trial, but they stood trial. Now, what's interesting about that is the civil authority and the military authority cannot be the same thing. Gold sheriffs and constables would call forth the militia if they had to make an arrest. They would deputize people to assist them to make an arrest. But they didn't walk around with guns to threaten you for driving through a traffic light or maybe having beer in your car or something like that. So what we've done is allowed a merging of the civil and the military authority in what we call the police officer. And once he draws that gun, he is military. And who gave him the authority to draw that gun in that instance? Himself. So he's the civil authority. So we've violated one of the major tenets of the English heritage in allowing police to exist. Now, police did not exist at the time of the founding of this country.
No, they did not.
They came in later, and my best understanding, it's hard to track it down, but the name policeman is actually policeman. He enforced the policy of the town, but he did it kind of as a constable, and he wasn't armed when he did it. In England, they weren't armed until fairly recently. When I was in London in the 60s, cops did not carry guns. They carried a nightstick. That was it. They were big guys, beefy, and then they had that big hat on top of their head, too. But they did not, force to them was grabbing you and giving you a bear hug until you submitted. It wasn't pulling out a gun and threatening you. And that's what it apparently, as near as I can tell, it used to be like in this country. Normally, too, you wouldn't be arrested unless it was serious. Otherwise, you would be given a notice to appear. And that was an agreement to appear in court to be heard on the charges. Now, Article, or the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution kind of addresses that. And
yes, it does.
I know we're off of Waco at this point, but, you know, we're not. I mean, Waco woke a lot of people up. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Now, defining a few terms. I can't find held to answer addressed directly, but held is what they did to somebody when they put him in goal, G-O-A-L, which is the same as jail. He was held in goal. An answer is what you do when you go to court to stand against the charges. So you cannot be put in jail until you go to court for capital or otherwise infamous crimes. Now, capital crimes are ones that can cost your life. Infamous crimes are what we now call felonies. And the original definition of an infamous crime was any crime where you could spend at least a year in prison, a year and a day in prison. So if it was a 6 month, it was not an infamous crime. Now, to presume then that if I shoot you, Randy, and kill you, which is capital, I can't be held to answer until a grand jury indicts me.
Correct.
Now, if you remember O.J. Simpson, his attorney was a little more astute than most, and he said you didn't have a grand jury indictment, so we want a probable cause hearing, and they had the probable cause hearing, which is this poor substitute for a grand jury, I think, but because the probable cause is done in front of the judge instead of in front of the grand jury. But the grand juries have been bastardized anyway, so it probably doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But if you could think that, you know, everything works in priorities. So if I shot you, Randy, and killed you, a grand jury would have to indict me. If I run a red light, how can I, without a driver's license, how can I get arrested and taken to jail without a grand jury indictment as well? For the lesser, for the misdemeanor, the cop, whose civil and military authority, will pull out his gun, take me to jail, and hold me there until I stand before the judge.
Exactly.
If I shoot you, I don't have to go through that.
Well, look at the protesters even then. I mean, look at protesters. We have the right to free speech and the right to peaceful assembly. And the right to voice our grievances against the government. And yet every time we try to do it, people are tear gassed, people are arrested, and I didn't see a grand jury convene on their arrest.
Well, I think that until we fight back and demand that which is ours, our rights, our heritage, the true law of this land, the intent of the Constitution, that we are submitting to that abuse of authority by the government.
I agree. You know, in 1968, when the Gun Control Act, the GCA Act of 1968 came out, you know, if every American walked out of their door with their guns and said, "No, you're not taking them, and you're not restricting them, and you're not legislating them, and you're not infringing upon my right to own these," what would they have done? Not a damn thing. They could not have enforced it.
Well,
no, I think that's what Americans forget. These laws are only laws as long as we allow them to remain laws. Because government,
well,
as the Declaration of Independence said, government exists only at the will of the people. And when
you said that we allow them to make those laws. We don't allow them to. The trouble is when they make the laws, we don't react properly.
That's what I'm saying. We don't allow them to make them. We allow them to keep them on the books, and we allow them to be able to enforce them because we don't stand up against the enforcement of them. And we don't have them removed from office for making unconstitutional laws.
Well, now, Randy, you and I have had some conversations since then, but go back, say, a month and what you knew then, and what brought on the April Lexington and Concord.
What brought it on?
Yeah.
They were coming to disarm the American people. They were coming to tax guns and take guns.
They were coming to take guns. But what led to that?
What led to it?
Yeah.
Wasn't it the Stamp Act that led to that?
Well, it's a good guess. You know, that's what we've been taught in school. I'm going to post a...
Educate me.
I am. I'm working on it. I'm going to post a link to an article that might be worth your time. We'll discuss it anyway as soon as I get the link posted and can get my mind back on what we're talking about. Okay, there's the link, and the article is The End of the Revolution and the Beginning of Independence. I believe that for a long time. I mean, we've got this lead-up. You know, we've got the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, the Stamp Act, and all these acts that were committed by the Crown and Parliament that were pissing people off. And so we assume, by what we've been told, that they led directly into the government going into seize arms in Lexington and Concord. There's a lot to history, and one thing about history, and I don't believe it was political to refine it down, but people like heroes, they like fixed dates, they like an easily told story, especially when you're teaching it to young kids so that they can remember and appreciate where we came from. But what I found out in a book, well documented, and what I've published has reference to the documentation, is that from May of 1774, 11 months before Lexington and Concord, to March 1775, the month before Lexington and Concord, maybe it goes into April as well, that there were a bunch of farmers, just common people in western Massachusetts, that would... They were going through difficult economic times. Because of the crown imposing these taxes, the money that existed in this country was being shipped back to England. There was very little specie, real money, circulating in this country. Now, people with farms might have borrowed some money in hard times to, you know, lost a cow and had to buy a cow or needed some chickens or something, or might even have land that he was buying from the owner of the land. And if he failed to make his payments, then it would be taken to court. And the courts were ruling against the farmers. Now, the courts were all the judges were the elite, the powerful people. And so all the verdicts were coming back in their favor. Yes, you have to turn over your cow and two chickens to this guy because you didn't pay him the money you owe him. So these farmers were getting outraged at this. Now, in the meantime, and shortly after the Boston Port Act, about a month later, another act called the Massachusetts Government Act came out. The Massachusetts Government Act said you will no longer pick your judges. Now, there's two kind of judges then. There's two courts then. They had the Oyer and Terminer courts, the court that we think of today, but then they also had the general court, which was the equivalent in Massachusetts of the legislature. It was the legislative body. And so the king is appointing the judges for the court and the delegates to the general court. And then he said only one town meeting per year, and your agenda has to be approved by the crown. Now, just to make it difficult to get approval of the agenda, you'd have to send it over, you know, 2 or 3 month voyage to England and 2 or 3 months back before you even knew what your agenda was going to be for your town meeting. Well, people had self-government, or at least to the extent that they had under British rule, which under their charters was pretty extensive, taken away from them, and they were outraged. So the first instance I ran across, they went with staves, you know, big sticks, staffs, and told the judges to resign and demanded they resign. The judges resigned. And when a judge resigned, he never withdrew. He never went back and said, I did it under force, so I'm going to keep my judgeship. He stayed resigned. But as this movement picked up, dozens of times in that year prior to Lexington and Concord, and in the next instance, instead of carrying guns or staves, they started carrying rifles. 10, 15, 20, 25,000 men coming together at a court to force the resignation of the judges or the delegates to the in Salem, they forced the delegates to the general court to resign, all except two who did not show up in Salem. They stayed in Boston. Anybody who didn't resign was never faced by these people with guns. They didn't go there when they found out it was happening. Instead, they went back to Boston and hid. So effectively, the courts were shut down. There were no courts. There was no legislature because everybody'd resigned, or enough to make a quorum and make the legislature work. They didn't have town meetings. They had committee of safety meetings. Or in some cases, they called them associations. They had different names, but effectively they were committees of safety. But the common use of committee of safety came later on when, on April 12, 1775, a week before Lexington and Concord, John Hancock, as president of the Provincial Committee of Safety, requested that all the towns, plantations, counties, and everybody create their own committees of safety. And then the name shifted almost completely to Committee of Safety. Three times at least, Gage had promised the courts that we're going to be shut down by these massive amounts of people with guns. Three times at least, he was had promised to send troops out of Boston to put down the rioters and not let them close the courts down. All three times, he wisely withdrew his offer and kept the troops in Boston. Now, in Boston at the time, he had 3,000 soldiers. That's not very many when you're facing 10 or 15 or 25,000 armed soldiers. Bad odds. One town, one county, Worcester, Massachusetts, actually had a declaration of independence. They unanimously, as the committee representing the county, withdrew their allegiance to England and even to the 1681 charter.
Okay.
And that precedes the Declaration of Independence by 17 months. They set up their own courts to handle criminal matters, but not civil. Under the circumstances, they didn't feel it was necessary to deal with civil matters. Gage then sent some soldiers to, I can't think of the town right now, but they had to cross a bridge to get there, but the townspeople had pulled up the planks on the bridge, and the British got there. The officer came forward and said, put those planks back. This is the Crown's Road. They said, this is not the Crown's Road. This is our road. We built it. And they made a deal, finally. They put the planks back because the officer agreed that he would march five rods past the bridge, turn around, and go back to Boston, which he did. But he was going there to seize the weapons that were stored there, and he gave up on his responsibility to the Crown because of this little run-in he had. In another case, I got a kick out of, there was a long barn, and the British, there were cannons in it, and rifles and powder and ball, and there were doors on each end of the barn, so the British had posted guards at both ends of the barn. So the Patriots came in and took the slats off the side of the barn, snuck in, got the cannons, the ball, the rifles, and the shot, and took them out and put the planks back, and the British don't know how they disappeared. Gage was getting a lot of pressure from England. You've got to do something. And he was saying, there's nothing I can do. And finally, on April 18th, 1775, he decided he was going to try and sneak into Lexington and get their firearms, or the cannon and rifle and powder and shot that they had stored in Lexington. So what led up to it had nothing to do with the Stamp Act. It had nothing to do with the things we've been taught. It had to do with realizing he was facing an armed camp that was arming themselves by stealing British. There was one more incident, Fort William and Mary. Paul Revere was a member of this team. They went to Fort William and Mary, took them by surprise, stole the cannon, the powder, and the shot from the British fort, and left the soldiers there. So the people were arming, and Gage had to try and stop it. And his way of stopping it was to try and sneak in and get one successful raid against the Patriots, which was April 19th. A new light on history?
Very new light on history, actually. You know that? And this is really why I enjoy our discussions. You know, like I said before, and anybody I've ever talked to about you.
Well, I've posted
you really
the link
find
to
those key parts of history that are long and lost to our knowledge.
They're not. More and more are coming out already, all the time. We've got a new, what's happening is there's a resurgence of people, and computers make it easier. It used to be you had to go through microfiche after microfiche, and now these things are being digitized and put online. There are other means, but people are beginning to go back and research original documents, which is what the information I just gave you. The book that I have has quotes and gives the source of each course, a letter from so-and-so or something that explains what all has happened. The book that I just finished reading and I'm going to write on is called American Scripture, and it was published in 1997, and it has over 90 declarations of independence that preceded the one on July 4th, 1776. Now, we have kind of been taught to believe that we had guys like Sam Adams, John Adams, Ben Franklin, all these people are up in Philadelphia saying, we need to declare independence. And you got jerks like Dickinson saying, no, we don't. We want to stick with the crown. That we followed them, that they led the way. On the contrary, they were late. There were only over 90 declarations. The first one I know of was the one from Worcester County. But there were over 90 declarations of independence, even out of South Carolina, long before John Hancock signed his name to the famous declaration. Now, the leaders then were not the leaders. They were the followers. They were the representatives of the people. And our concept of leadership right now is turned upside down. These people worked their ways up from committees of safety or representing the people and being recognized as the people as being popular and speaking the people's minds. They were pushed up to the Provincial Congress and then up to the Continental Congress. And those became the people that we revere as our leaders. But they weren't leaders. George Washington was a leader because he went in front of his troops quite often. But these other guys were following the will of the people below them. And it was becoming so overwhelming that they had no choice but to declare independence. Interesting sidelight on history. But when I get this new article, and I don't know what the title will be, I've got it started. When I'm done with it, it will have reference to the documents that are still available that show these 90 other declarations of independence in various forms. I mean, different wording, different people, but basically the same thing. Some qualify it that we absolve our relationship with Great Britain until such time as the immediate problems are dealt with. So they were qualified. But in fact, they said, screw Great Britain until this is done. And others just blatantly, like Worcester, walked away from Britain and said, screw you, we have nothing to do with you anymore. And these go a year, over a year, before those people in Philadelphia caught up with the people. Now, the difference between representation today and then is rather intriguing when you think about it. I'm going to use the analogy I used on a response to a guy that I was discussing it with earlier. The Democratic Party decides who's going to run locally, statewide, and for president. The Democratic Party decides who's going to run locally, statewide, and for president. They're all party men. They've earned their way up. If you want to run for a state, you've got to have been a party member long enough or kissed enough ass or whatever it takes to be a party man, a dyed-in-the-wool party man, obliged to the party, submissive to the party, do the will of the party.
Correct.
Before you go on the ballot. Now, that's not how it worked back then. But the analogy is this. The Republican Party dangles a turd for you to grab. The Democratic Party dangles a turd for you to grab. If you vote for either one of them, you're going to get a turd. It's not somebody that represents the people. Now think, these guys earned their way up that ladder by curing the will of the people. And they were expected, and quite often they went as a delegate with instructions written. You shall not do this. In fact, the Declaration of Independence, I don't recall how many, at least five colonies had to send back to their state because they were instructed not to go with independence. And they had to write back to their state and say, can we go for independence? Or the colony. And the colony would say, yes, you can go for independence. But their instructions, they would not violate. Now, those instructions then were dictated from below. Nowadays, they're called campaign promises. Back then, they stuck to what they were told. Nowadays, they don't stick to their promises. So when you go down to vote, you're going to get this turd or that turd. He's going to lie to you, and you're going to vote for the best liar.
Exactly.
That's politics in America today.
We have party men. We don't have representatives. We have people that represent their parties, not the American.
No, and I don't want to offend any Republicans or Democrats listening, but there's no difference between the party. They're going towards a one-world government. They're going to absolute submission by us. They're going to tax us to the extent that they can get away with, and that number keeps going up. And if you look indirectly at taxes, if I hire you for $10 an hour, you don't get $10 an hour. You've got to charge about $13 or $14 an hour, maybe $15 an hour, for you to walk away with $10. So if you're worth $10 an hour, I got to pay you $15 an hour, or 50% more than you're worth, in taxes. I'm paying that taxes so that you can get your $10 an hour. Then I have to pay taxes on my own income. And when health care hits in and starts getting their share of the shit, but you got Social Security, withholding tax, Medicare, unemployment compensation in some states, the employee gets to pay a little share of that. There are all these things that you pay in there, and it's not just coming out of your check, because when you buy a service from somebody, you've got to pay their taxes, and the people they buy services have to pay their taxes. So the taxes we're paying are a lot higher than we realize. I remember back about 89 or 90, I was talking to a guy, and he showed me an article that was rather interesting. And I wish I still had a copy, but when I was out of Florida once, everything I had disappeared. But it was about a car, and this is back when cars cost about $10,000, you know, $8,000 to $12,000 for a decent car. And it said, would you buy this car if, and it showed a picture of a car, the price tag was $10,000. Well, yes. Now, would you buy this car if the price tag was, and I think it was $1,800, taxes $8,200. Would you?
God, no. Why would
well,
I do that?
Then it broke down the fact that you were paying $8,200 in taxes for $1,800 worth of car when you look at the expenses. The guy had gone through, you know, the charges against the pulling steel out of the ground, the coal, all these charges that are tacked onto this thing from its raw material in the ground to the finished product, the car. And the $8,200 is what was paid out in taxes to get that car to you at $10,000.
Well, you know, today, if you look at it, with all the taxes that we have, you know, right now, each person pays over 200 taxes every day. Now, when you compile all those taxes, you find that almost 60% of the average person, that the average wage earner's income out there is taxed. That means we're living on 40% of what we actually work. So that basically means that from January till about the end of August, beginning of September, you worked for somebody else.
Yes. Now look at
you get to reap the rewards from September, October, November, December. You get 4 months out of the year where you actually get to keep your money.
Now, keep in mind what I just told you, though. Now that you've got your money, you're paying more than you should for what you're buying, because in the case of the car, 82% of what you were paying is going to pay taxes as well. So you're getting shorted on both sides.
You're paying more taxes.
You're getting shorted on both sides. You're having it taken out of yours before you get to spend it, but then you're having it, you know, you're paying more for the product you buy because of it.
Exactly. You know, we don't understand that. You know, we hear about all these carbon tax, you know, this carbon tax that's coming up and all these other taxes and how it's going to be pushed upon the corporations out there. Well, here's a newsflash, Economics 101. Corporations make profit. That's all they do. Their bottom line is profit.
Mm-hmm.
When their profit margins are interfered with, what do? They raise the prices to get their profit margins back up to where they need them to be, where they
right.
expect them to be. So if, you know, if these corporations are all hit with, you know, carbon, you know, with carbon taxes or consumption taxes or whatever the taxes that they're looking at, they're looking at several different taxes right now ranging up to upwards of 22%. Well, all they're going to do is tack that back, is they're just going to pass those expenses back on to us, the consumers.
Well, you know, a good demonstration of that is maybe 6-7 years ago when you got your phone bill, their service charge was higher than it is now.
Yes,
but
it was.
And the phone companies were getting tired because they kept getting stuck with these federal and state taxes, and finally they broke them out, so the service charge went way down, and they started itemizing, and I think on our phone bill we get 7 different taxes that were all lost in the service charge before. But we didn't realize we were paying taxes with the service charge until they broke it out. But the phone company, when the government raised the taxes again, phone company had to raise their service charge, and people were complaining, how come you're raising the service charge? Well, then they broke out and showed that their service charge wasn't nearly as high as it appeared to be, but that they had been absorbing all those taxes. So, say, out of a $23 service charge, now it breaks down to maybe $12 in service charge and $11 in taxes. But they've opted to start itemizing the taxes, or at least AT&T did.
Well, you know, and if we look back, you know, to the topic of this, you know, the show tonight, Waco, we find that Waco was the culmination. You know, they used the excuse of taxes to go after them.
Well, yes and no, because they didn't announce to the public that they were going for a $200 tax if there were automatic taxes.
Right.
Rifles.
You know, but
Now, why would they have an arrest warrant as well for David Koresh for not paying taxes? I didn't know they issued arrest warrants for not paying taxes. I thought they took you to tax court.
I thought so, too, but, you know, we now, if we look at the IRS, if we look at taxation, if you look at the definition of taxation and the definition of slavery, one would be amazed at how close they are together. So how do you make your slaves behave? Well, you threaten them with use of force. We have the IRS that threatens us with use of force, and now we have a militarized IRS. But we also have other tax agencies out there, which people don't realize, and in fact, many of our corporations themselves are these tax agencies. They collect the taxes for the government and put them and pass them on to the government, much like our businesses who collect sales tax. They are tax collectors. That's the bottom line. All these people are tax collectors, and every government agency out there that collects tax in one way or the other uses force.
Well, you know what the Founding Fathers did to tax collectors, don't you?
Oh, I know what they did. They tarred and feathered them. They sent them on their
way. Right. Some of them survived, too.
They sent them on their way. You know, it goes back to... You know, and I think back, you know, what would the Founding Fathers have done in our situation today? You know, let's say, like, for instance.
It never would have gotten this far.
That's what I'm saying. You know, but let's say, for instance, today, you know, Washington is sitting at home with Martha. And let's say Washington had kids. You know, Washington's sitting at home with Martha. And they're having a nice dinner. And they get a knock at the door. And here is a lady from the government that they, that, you know, the Founding Fathers just recently created. And here comes a lady at the door with a couple of sheriff behind her or, you know, police or whatever. And they say, hello, Mr. Washington, we're here because we have concerns about how you're raising your children and what you're teaching them. And we feel that it is in the best interest of your children if we take them from you and give them to somebody else to raise. You know, how would they feel? How would they have reacted to this?
Well, I think that we wouldn't, as I say, we wouldn't have gotten this far. The moral courage that it takes to stand up against the government just happened to manifest itself then. It was easier, though, because think of the courage for, say, 20,000 men to pick up their rifles and go to court and say, judges, you resign then. Now, think what happens now. Now, remember back then, I could go down and buy a cannon. I could buy all the powder and lead and cannonball that I wanted. And it wasn't tracked on some computer in Washington.
No, it was not.
So the implementation of a lot of the laws that apply in this country today are an effort to enhance the government's ability to violate the Constitution and the whole concept of this country even more.
You know, I've got a question for you. You know, going back to Waco and some of the things that we've talked about, you know, like you were bringing up the committees and mentioning the committees, and you and I agree on this very much so. If we want to save this country, you know, just like the Founding Fathers openly stated, you know, they said that the Revolutionary War could not have been won if it was not for the committees of safety. You know, and I think that so much of what we're trying to do and the efforts that we're working towards are null and void because we're not operating from a position of authority because we don't have the committees of safety anymore.
Well, that's it. I mean,
no,
the analogy I used there, when I went to Vietnam, the people behind me, over my shoulder, said, you have the right to kill the enemy. We will take responsibility for the moral and the legal implications of what you do. That makes it easy to happen. So when we're talking about these farmers, when they're sent by their committee of safety to go up to Worcester or Salem or somewhere to shut down the court, they can look over their shoulder and they've given us the moral responsibility. That's where the civil and military authority comes in. Because the community says, collectively, you have a right to do this. That takes the moral and legal burden off of me to do it. If we had committees of safety, as they had then, and anything, the First Continental Congress was called by the committees of safety locally, and it went up the ladder. Everything. The committees of safety were the fountain of energy that flowed through the people to allow the revolution to occur. Now, if we had committees of safety, we would have that same thing.
Well, like you were mentioning before, you know, we had talked about the grand juries many years ago, you know, last year, in fact, extensively, and the committees. So, like you said, the grand juries, they're not coming from a position of authority because they're not coming from the committees of safety. A grand jury isn't being appointed to make these presentments by a committee of safety.
Yeah, what can you self-appoint yourself to in this country?
Well, I can't appoint myself to anything.
Oh, well, the grand juries can't either, then, I suppose. The Committee of Safety can because it represents and it's a voluntary. The Albany Committee of Safety, for example, even though they call themselves the Committee of Safety, they were an association. And these people voluntarily joined the association. As members of the association, they saw themselves as representing the community, even though there might have been another government down the road that had a British flag over it. These people saw themselves as representing the community that was at that point just at odds with the British government. But they were volunteers into this group, but they represented the committee, and anybody in the community could become members if they took the pledge. Once they became members and represented the community, though, then they have the authority to appoint, which they did in Western Massachusetts. In some cases, they discharged all of the militia and then opened the militia rolls again. Anybody suspected of being a Tory or inimical to the cause of America was not allowed to join the militia, and when they were done, they selected the officers because they knew that these people were loyal and faithful to the American cause. So they actually threw the militia out and brought it back in where they knew that these people would be obedient to the Committee of Safety. The court that was set up in Worcester, once they did their Declaration of Independence, and I don't have the documentation on this, it only is not quotational text, but then they proceeded to set up courts for criminal purposes, but I don't have the exact quotes on that. But they set up their courts. Now, they set up the courts because they had the authority, because they represented the community. When I was in Ohio investigating the murder of Michael Hill, the militia chaplain, I was in Columbus, and they were having a grand jury, and I was invited down to it. And so I went down there, and when they set up the grand jury, then they wanted two jurists from out of state. And they knew I was from Florida, so they said, "Jerry, will you sit on the jury?" And I said, "Okay," and I went up there. We sat and we heard things, and you know, it was a done deal. I mean, there wasn't really anything presented. I just decided I'd go along with it. What the hell? Afterwards, I went down. The guys that had set this whole thing up was invited over to their place. And in fact, I think I slept on the couch that night at their house. But we were talking about it, and I said, "Where do you get the authority to appoint yourself as grand jury?" And, well, somebody's got to do it. We have the authority because we're free men in this country. And I said, you know, I find nothing that says, you know, look at the Constitution. In the Constitution, for example, the federal courts have to be set up by the Congress. Not by the president, but by the Congress. Whatever courts they want to create, Article 3. In any state constitution, the legislature sets up the courts. In a county, the county commission or whatever body they have in that county sets up the courts. Courts don't set themselves up. More importantly about a court, though, is the fact that you've got to enforce the edicts of the court. Now, how do you enforce anything? By force. Now, where does that force come from? Well, in the case of Worcester, it came from the militia that was subordinate to the same committee that set up the courts. So now we've got the court that's appointed, not self-appointed, but appointed, and they're appointed by the committee, and the militia is appointed by the committee. So the committee is basically directing, when the court comes out with an edict, say that this guy should be arrested and put in jail for being a Tory, then they tell the militia, go arrest this guy and put him in jail. So that chain of authority, anything, has to be appointed by the legislative body of the community. Now, if there's a legislative body with an executive, they might delegate to the executive that authority, which was true, say, in the colonies. The governor was the colonial authority. He was the executive. The general court was the legislative body. So the legislative body didn't send the troops out, but Hutchinson or Gage later on, being the executive authority, would send would direct the forces to go do things. So that structure of subordination goes back, as I said, to the Magna Carta. You can find reference to that subordination all the way back then, 1260 or whenever it was. So that's 800 years.
800 years ago.
Yeah, and we've had this concept of subordination to civil authority. The community is the body. And you don't have to live in the community. If you don't like it, move. You can't do that to a state. You can't do that to the federal. But in a community, you can. So if you don't like it, you leave. But that community, its legislative body, its civil body, is the authority within that community to direct what will happen and who will do it in that community. Nobody else has the authority in any way, shape, or form to assume that they have the right.
Okay, I got a question for you. Freedom's News Hour asked what you think about the Manning trial. He actually had the New York State Supreme Court monitoring the entire proceeding. What do you think about his grand jury?
Well, I haven't looked into that. I'm not sure. That was done on a university, wasn't it?
It was done at his church, I believe, wasn't it?
On a church? Sounds like an ecclesiastic court. I thought we got rid of those. I don't know. I have not looked into that. I know there's been a lot of talk about it. If you ask the Supreme Court if they would review your records when you were done, and they graciously said yes, that doesn't mean that they're empowering them to come to a decision. The only thing I've seen, though, is I got an email, gave me a link that I haven't gone to yet, but it also says that they have found him guilty of fraud.
Manning?
That Manning trial, no, found Obama guilty of fraud.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Manning trial was being done with the American grand jury as well, I believe. In fact, it was the American grand jury who were doing the presentments for the Manning trial.
Well, the question, though, and here arises the question, if the provost marshals or the other people assigned by the grand jury to enforce the edicts can manage to enforce them or get the existing state or federal government to enforce them, fine, it works. What happened, and that's, you know, is just like Wapner's court. Two people walk in, they agree to go abide by that court. But what happens when one of the parties says, screw you, I'm not subject to your jurisdiction, which is what habeas corpus is all about. Now, what happens at that point? Now, who's going to enforce the edict of the court? There is no militia that's subordinate to the same body that created the court. So who are they going to direct to enforce the edict? So if it works, if that trial holds and people in the federal and or state government are willing to enforce the edict of that court, and Obama is bound for trial for on the charges of fraud, which is what I understand with the verdict they came up with, or a charge, I'm not sure if they were operating as a grand jury, so it would be an indictment, I guess. Or some nature.
Well, listen, Gary, I hate to cut you off, but we're down to our last 90 seconds, man. The time just flies with you. Start throwing out your website and your info and tell people how to get in touch with you and how to get in touch with you about the committees of safety especially.
Well, rather than post it, it's outpost-of-freedom.com, and almost every page on there down at the bottom you'll find a mail link. On the main page, I think the mail link is right at the top and at the bottom. If anybody has any questions or wants to get in touch with me, I do have a bad habit. If you send me an email and don't call me nasty names, I will generally respond to whatever length is necessary to answer your questions. So feel free to contact me if you wish. And I want to thank everybody who took the time to listen tonight. I hope you've learned something. And if you have any questions about what we've talked about, do email me. Okay.
Oh, well, listen, Gary, I appreciate you coming on, and thank you so much for all the, for the last three shows that you've been on with us. You know, it really brought to light a lot of the things that I didn't know about Waco. So with that being said, thank you, everybody, for coming on and listening. We really appreciate you. We appreciate your work out there and the effort you're trying to do to bring freedom about in your own community. So keep up the good work, everybody, and keep working hard every day. Go and check out the U of Trinity demand. Gary and I worked on that for a very long time, culmination of many years' worth of research and study. It's actually a fix to all the problems we have here in America, and there's actually a plan with it. So read that. Get in touch if you have any questions on it. RandyMack@YouHaveTreadOnMe.com. I hope to hear everybody soon. Our next show is going to be Tuesday, same time, 7:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, and we hope to see everybody there then. Take care, everyone, and you have a great day. Bye-bye.